Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 9th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Gates to the Holy City, People and Land, Session 2, Damascus Gate and Dung Gate, Shared Holy Sites and Land, presented by Susan and Michael Thomas. The number is THMS 2002-02. Let's listen in.
Pastors of the Church of the Redeemer in the Old City of Jerusalem, the walled city of Jerusalem. We've been there for 4 years. We were sent by the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA to work with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, in other words, the Palestinian Lutheran Church, to assist them, to be in conversation with them. And the primary way that we assist them is pastoring an international English-speaking congregation. In addition to the English-speaking congregation, there's the German-speaking congregation. That church was founded in the mid-19th century. They built the church that the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, the site is on. It's an old Crusader church, an old room that was rebuilt at the end of the 19th century. And then, of course, there's the Palestinian Arabic-speaking congregation, as well as the offices of the bishop and the ELCJ church offices, all on the church compound of the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer. One of the things that I forgot to mention last night is how much we would welcome a visit from you, how important it is to come now. It is not an easy time to come. There's certainly no guarantee of anyone's safety. I mean, I think you can be relatively safe. You don't go to where that are known flashpoints. You don't ride buses. You don't go to... How many of you would be going to discos? Okay. Or you don't go to late-night coffee houses. And that is certainly a limitation on one's life, one's freedom of movement. But that's the way it is. But it is very important for Christians to come and witness with the Christians of the Holy Land, to simply see, and also to meet with Israeli Jews that are working for peace, that are in protest, in a kind of position of protest to their own government's actions in the West Bank. What we're going to do today is have a briefer slide show than we have last evening. Susan will be the main presenter today, and then we'll try to have significant time for discussion. So if someone could turn those lights off, switch in the two dials, we'll begin. Today we're going to go in through the Damascus Gate, which is the main Palestinian entree into the Old City. And then just to maybe it's fits coming on. And to orient you once again, we're going to show you the 6th century Madaba map. Madaba is a small city in Jordan. It was a map, a mosaic, that covered about the size of this floor that was made in the 6th century. And then through an earthquake and destruction by the Persians, the map was essentially covered up and lay undiscovered, unknown, until the late 19th century. This is a facsimile. This is in Jerusalem, and it's the holy city of Jerusalem. The map covers the whole known world in the 6th century. It's of extreme interest for historians and archaeologists about how the world was understood. It's a Christian map. It's making a Christian political perspective on the world. At the center of that map is Jerusalem, and at the center of Jerusalem is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which we pointed out. These would be the stairs that you would come up. You would come through these three entrances into a courtyard and then into this magnificent church that Constantine built, and that was a statement certainly as much of piety as of political intent. against Rome, that Christians could have an edifice that was as grand as anything Rome could build for pagan gods.
So how much of this is still left? Is there anything left of this?
Most of it. Most of this section is pretty much as it is.
And how big is that approximately?
It's about the size of this room.
No, I mean the actual area.
That right there, that's about the actual size.
Oh, so when you're asking how much of this is left, is how many
I don't mean how much
buildings
the, yeah,
and
yeah,
things?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, very, very little. I'm sorry. I thought you meant about the map itself.
You can walk down. This street has been excavated. You can walk down this street. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is still there, but it's gone through numerous rebuildings as it was destroyed numerous times.
I want to point out right over here.
And this is the most fascinating thing about the map today.
So, go ahead.
Go ahead. Why don't you say the name of the gate in Arabic?
This gate is Damascus Gate.
So if you were to go through that gate, you would go, as you would expect, to Damascus.
And the name in Arabic is Bab al-Amud.
Bab al-Amud. Yeah.
And that means Gate of the Column. And this name was retained for centuries.
And no one knew why
it was called Gate of the Column until this map was rediscovered. And you see a column here. And so the Arabic name referenced something that used to be there, which entered or disappeared out of people's actual memories, but the name remained. And so it's a kind of sign of the symbol, the sign of the way that there's hidden histories that you see little glimpses of in this land that have been covered over or destroyed.
And as we mentioned, Jerusalem is a walled city. It takes about an hour and a half to walk around the old city. And this is the Dome of the Rock. Under that golden dome is the rock that both Muslims and Jews claim a kind of symbolic importance, where Isaac was going to be sacrificed, where Muhammad left for his night trip. Okay, so we're going to enter the Damascus Gate. This is the gate that was on the map that Susan pointed out. Today is market day, and it is bustling. It is. There are people that set up stalls early in the morning. Clothes, watches, cell phones, vegetables. Anything you could need, you can buy in about 50 yards.
Now, people can still go there today? Or?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a Palestinian market. Mm-hmm.
And so you walk through here. Let me just point out, up in this opening is a soldier, Israeli soldier, watching over. And just on the other side of the wall, there's always two to four soldiers that are there to question Palestinians and to preserve order. So we're going to go through the gate.
And this is inside then?
No, we just entered into the gate. It's an L-shaped gate, and that's a defensive gate so that an army besieging the city gate could not enter straight away, but they would have to make a 90-degree left turn and then a 90-degree right turn. So that's a military function, and you can always change money. So we have a checking account in the United States, but what we do is we write checks at a little money changer's office on one of the streets in East Jerusalem, and we can write a check for $5,000 to buy airline tickets, and without the money changer blinking an eye. You do have the sense that you would not want to write a bad check. come through. And this is so typical to see women, Palestinian women, often wearing the dress of their village, of their area, selling vegetables everywhere in East Jerusalem.
It's interesting. You see the women only doing this kind of ad hoc sort of selling of agricultural products generally. They aren't the shop owners. They aren't the merchandisers. They kind of come in and sit.
Can you always tell the difference between Israelis and Palestinians and the way they dress?
Usually,
but not always. Yeah.
And then we've just come through the gate and we're looking down the street. So the column that Susan pointed out would have been about right here. And it was part of a Roman grand entrance into the city. And then we didn't quite get this picture done. And so I took a picture this morning from a guidebook. And I'll let, since Susan insisted that I take the picture, she'll describe.
Well, it's in the wrong place, actually. It needs to come after the next section. But this, we're going to be moving to Dung Gate, which is down over here. But Damascus Gate would be an entrance that's up over here into the city. And it would have brought people who were coming to Al-Aqsa, the noble sanctuary, Al-Aqsa Mosque, Dome of the Rock, whatever, Temple Mount.
This is where Sharon went?
Sharon went, right. They would have come in this way, or from another entrance over here to this area.
We'll show pictures from that perspective another day. Sharon came up, there's a walkway here. This is the Western Wall. And one thing I know it's impossible really to see. What you have to imagine is that until 1967, there was an Arab neighborhood that went all the way up to the wall. It was just 12 feet from the wall. And after the 1967 war, the Israelis overnight cleared out this entire plaza. It's a large plaza to make room for worshipers that would come. And that's again, I mean, it's the sense, in a small way, it's a sense of the Palestinian reality of being displaced. Now, there are also reasons why, of course, this wall is the holiest site for Judaism. And then that is also a controversial notion about whether this wall in some way replaces the temple, whether it should have the kind of reverence that is shown to it. And it's also important to remember that the Jordanians had agreed to allow Jews to come to the wall prior to 1967, between 1948 and 67, and Jews were never allowed to come. And so when they came, there was this tremendous sense of, it was a kind of miracle. It was viewed as a kind of miracle that Jews once again had access to the Western Wall. And then Israeli generals and government leaders wisely decided not to try to, in any way, reconquer the Temple Mount or the Haram Sharif, the noble sanctuary, as it's known in Arabic, but to allow Muslim autonomy of that area. So this is the Al-Aqsa Mosque right here. This is where thousands of people worship on Fridays. And then during pilgrimage time, other religious holidays, and especially during Ramadan, there'll be 100,000 people up here. And so if you go to the tower of our church and look down, all you see is this ocean of white, of people bent over, bowing, kneeling.
So just to make clear, because this was the area where the temple was, the temple that Jesus visited, that Solomon had built, and the second temple that was built then prior to that Herod had built prior to Jesus' time, and then This area, of course, is a very sacred area for Jews. And it's also a sacred area for Muslims, because this is the site that in their understanding, Ishmael was the son that Abraham almost sacrificed.
So can anybody go there now? Is that open or is that closed?
It's been closed.
It's been closed since the beginning of the...
Yeah, except on one occasion. There is a family named Husseini in Jerusalem, and the Husseini family is a kind of noble clan, and one of the descendants of this clan was Faisal Husseini, who died a little bit more than a year ago in May 2001, and so there was a large funeral. He was in Kuwait, and he had a heart attack. His body was brought back to Ramallah by the Jordanians. And then there was a huge march, a funeral procession, that came from Ramallah to Jerusalem. And the Israelis wisely, essentially, simply, the soldiers, police, simply disappeared for the day. And it was a wonderful experience. We met the coffin at what is called Orient House, which belonged to the Husseini family, which was sort of the unofficial Palestinian governmental office in Jerusalem, and marched behind the coffin, or actually not a coffin, but the body that was carried, that was wrapped in linen, through Damascus Gate. So you saw that gate, and you have to imagine a Palestinian flag at least as large as this room that was also carried. And it was a wise decision by the Israelis simply to disappear and trust the organizers of the procession to maintain order. And for Palestinians, it was a kind of day of celebration because East Jerusalem became their city again. And then we went through Damascus Gate and wound our way to the Haram. And on that day, as a kind of gesture of hospitality to complete the final burial, they invited those of us who were processing, mostly people from governments and NGOs and clergy, to come up and have a role in that. It was really a wonderful sense. Probably 200 people said to me, welcome, when I walked into the Temple Mount area, to the Haram. And so that's the one day it's been open to non-Muslims.
So the Muslims are able to worship there still daily.
Yes,
it's just
they are and they aren't. Yeah. I mean, it's been closed off many, many times to people.
On Fridays to men, it varies in age, but anywhere from say 15 to 45.
And so often, what will happen in those cases is that the people will out in the streets then. They will do their prayers. It's a very impressive sight to see people, and we can see two areas where that happens from our house. They will simply put down their prayer rugs and do their prayers then in the street when they are not allowed to go in. And it's a remarkable scene when that happens. It's been one of the major issues of the Intifada, is access to the holy places.
And so you see many thousands of people there, but they're Israeli Arabs, not Palestinian Arabs, not Palestinians from the West Bank.
Which is, again, you know, just for the sake, it's a very complicated situation there. An Israeli Arab is an Israeli citizen who is Palestinian, and those who have lived in Israel proper, can have Israeli citizenship. that may be something that people are not aware of. Mm. So an Israeli
so
Arab, when you
move,
say that,
move
is a,
on.
Yeah. Okay. To move on. Okay.
Now this is strange visually, and I realized as I was putting the slides together last night. In all the gates that we're going to show you, we're going in. In this one gate, all the traffic is out. And so it feels disorienting to me. And so we're looking at Dung Gate, which has that name. It means something like trash gate. And that name comes from Arabic, and I think it maybe goes back to Roman times, when after the Jewish revolts, the Temple Mount was simply cleared. And this is the gate that a lot of the stones that weren't used for other building projects was taken out.
So if you recall the map we just, or the picture we just saw, this gate would have been down in this area.
This is in the southeastern corner of the...
to the western wall. I don't end up.
So today, how hard would it be to walk through that entrance?
You can do it.
No problem. A Palestinian will be questioned by the police that are there.
Going back to your original, yesterday and today, the wall area that you're speaking about, you said was a really small part of what's now...
It's about a mile square.
But what's, how big is it?
About a mile square.
A mile square.
And the wall, this wall dates from the 16th century. And so and it's a one-way. You can't drive in except for buses.
Again, the ubiquitous soldiers everywhere and vehicles.
And then this is from the inside, looking out. And so behind me and to the left is the Western Wall.
We're sort of doing a from the gate now, looking.
So this is David City is right outside this wall here, and then right below it there are excavations where. If there's every good reason to think that Christians lived in that area and had house churches in the early Christian era. And then the buildings in the distance are Palestinian buildings. And then what looks like maybe a barren hillside, we'll see a better picture, is a very large Jewish cemetery on the Mount of Olives. There you see it better. So this is Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is the southern exposure of the wall. And then this is this large Jewish cemetery that I mentioned. And then on top is a hotel that many pilgrims stay at. It's empty now, called the Seven Arches. It was an intercontinental hotel. It was opened during Jordanian time. And just to show how sort of painful and sensitive are the realities of this place, there were Jewish graves that were vandalized and used in the building of the hotel. And so that's, it happens on all sides where what is religious, what is holy and sacred is vandalized or ruined. So you'll see many, many in Israel, many villages where you can see the minaret and it's been destroyed, is no longer functioning in any way as a religious site.
You said the Seven Arches is empty now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could probably stay there, but there's really no one there.
Why are there no people for
the Church of the Ascension, the Ascension is up in the tower. Okay, do you want to start with these maps or do you want to come to the
I think I'd like to have a little bit of time before we go to the maps. Okay, so could we turn on some lights again?
So what was the church with all the trouble that we just saw on that? With people walking out and...
That was the
That's
church.
Not your church.
No, the Church of the Nativity.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that a little bit too if we have time today. Okay. As another holy site that is outside of Jerusalem in Bethlehem. the church where Jesus, that over the site, traditional site where Jesus was born. What we said we were going to do today was to be thinking about the kind of economic disaster that has happened for both Palestine and Israel in these past 2 years. For Palestinians, it's a much longer kind of trajectory of economic disaster. We wanted to talk about how you share land, share holy sites. We put out a keffiyeh as a sign of it's not strictly Muslim, but it's supposed to be for our use now, a sign of the Muslim influence, a Hasidic Jewish figure, and the little basket with crosses, which if you didn't get one last night, you're welcome to take one with you today, as a sign of those three faiths together in Jerusalem and in the greater area. And it's a very difficult question, how these three faiths can live together. Today we are going to talk mostly about, though, how this has played out for ownership of land and control of access to places. First of all, I think it's important that we understand that Arabs and Jews have not been eternally enemies, and it's too simplistic to imply that. To say, well, they've just been fighting from day one, what can we do, you know, and that's easy it's a kind of cop-out on what is real. You might go back to the Ishmael and Isaac stories, the two sons of Abraham, one by Hagar the Egyptian and one by Sarah, and the Jewish people, of course, and the Christians look to Isaac, the progeny of Abraham and Sarah, and that line of promise that God gave. Traditionally, then the Arab peoples and then Muslim belief look to Ishmael as the descendants that they claim to Abraham. It's also not that simple. What we remember, though, in that story of Isaac and Ishmael is that what happened when Isaac was born, finally, to Sarah and Abraham, there was a kind of response, not only a joy on the part of Sarah, but also of fear and a sense of worry that Ishmael, the son that had been born prior to Isaac by Hagar, that somehow this other son might encroach on the rights of Isaac. And so what was a blessing became really a catastrophe for Ishmael, because Sarah then, with Abraham's acquiescence, cast out Ishmael and Hagar into the wilderness and to protect the rights of her son. And that's a terrible story in the Bible. But what is very interesting to realize is that, in fact, God intervenes. And as Hagar and Ishmael are out in the wilderness without water, without food, God comes to Hagar and shows her where there is water, tells her that her son also, by Abraham, will be the father of many nations. And in fact, then we have a little story about how she went to Egypt and found him a wife, and he became a a hunter and a farmer, and then later on in Genesis we have a listing of his 12 sons, and we see, in fact, that he and Isaac come back and bury Abraham together. So even in this story of the way that a blessing is turned to become a catastrophe for the other, you see that there is still a blessing for the one to whom the catastrophe occurred because of God's intervention, and you see some sense of reconciliation at the end at the burial of Abraham. So to keep that in mind is probably important. It's also important to realize that it's not fair to say or not accurate to say that, you know, we've got the descendants of Isaac over here and the descendants of Ishmael over here. It's just, you know, 4,000 years is not going to, there's not going to be pure bloodlines of any sort. That is likely. Palestinians are descendants of all of the ancient peoples in that land, including Jewish people. It's very clear that among the Palestinians there will be ancestors who were Jewish, and that's interesting also to realize. Arabs and Jews lived in relative harmony for 13 centuries in the land, in the Middle East and in North Africa. And it was really in Europe that the Jews fared tragically with the pogroms and the Holocaust and the Spanish Inquisition. So it's just important to remember that Jews and Arabs are not doomed to violence and strife. We shouldn't think that, although we're seeing it presently. One of the things that's very impressive to us as we work with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, the Palestinian Lutheran Church, is to see in the leadership very much of a desire to maintain conversation and dialogue with Israeli Jews. And it's very impressive. We have never had the sense that any of those pastors have hatred and bitterness in their hearts for the Israelis. And I think this is a remarkable, remarkable thing to see. Okay, maybe we can go to the maps now. Okay. So what we're going to look now at are several maps, and they're not going to be that easy to see. So the basic idea that we want you to understand is that there's a kind of whittling away at what the Palestinians might have as their land. I'm going to need a little bit of light as well.
While we're waiting for the map to come on, let me just mention, in terms of Susan's last point about the lack of bitterness and the desire for good relationships with Jews, that at the Church of at Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, following a siege during the month of April, on the first Sunday the community could gather again for worship. And in essence celebrate the resurrection and celebrate Easter after a very hard month, five weeks, very difficult times. There were five Jews present in the congregation that came at the invitation of the bishop and the pastor in the congregation to be there, to be with the community, and to try to epitomize the importance of making neighbors of your enemies and not enemies of your neighbors.
In the late 19th century, Theodor Herzl, who was an Austrian Jew, began the Zionist movement, which was a movement to try to establish a state for Jews, to which, in a sense, all Jews in the whole world would belong, and to which they could always come. And he looked at several places, Uganda, places around the world.
Where else? Madagascar.
Places to think of possibly establishing this kind of a homeland, and finally decided that the place to do this would be in Palestine. And this is the wrong map. This is not the right map. Let's see which one map is the... There it is. Okay. And this was the area. This is a map from 1919 that the Zionist Congress, which was this organization of Jewish people that were interested in this kind of a state, set out. And it is basically the Jordan River. I can't see this, I'm sorry. Okay, this is Amman, Jordan here. Okay, so this is covering a very large area of what is present day kind of Israel with the West Bank inside it. Okay, so it's basically that map. But that was the intention, was to have that whole land become a state for Jews. Let's go to the next one. It was a colonial approach. It was at the end of colonialism. Here was a decision to colonize an area of the world, to recolonize an area of the world, and to realize that kind of colonial expansionist idea going on here in the Holy Land is an important thing. And when Palestinians speak about what's happened to them, they very much want people to understand that colonial mentality, that of a foreign presence coming in, since there were very few Jews, although there were Jews in this area, but there were very few there. So most who came in at that point and later were indeed foreigners.
But wasn't that also at that time a British protectorate of some sort?
Right at 1990, yeah, right about that time it was beginning.
So it was already colonially, I mean, it wasn't...
True.
Before that, hadn't the Ottomans?
No.
But, yes, but what we're seeing is that really the colonial idea at that was diminishing in the world at that point, at the same point as this Zionist dream was expanding. So that you had the British colonial or mandate, but it was, as that diminished, the Zionist idea expanded, is the basic point here.
This is proposed, or this?
This was their proposed idea.
Okay.
Their proposed idea. What area of land in 1919 they would wanted to try to claim as a Zionist state.
Hasn't Jews begun to migrate back to this land, like,
before
the 18th century, going up to this point? Like, there was a reason why they started to think about this Zionist state, was because Jews from all over the world had begun to migrate back to this area, had they not?
There had been some, yeah, prior to 1919. At 1919, the British mandate was also very sympathetic to this Zionist idea. Mm-hmm. So it became easier as well. Okay, next. Again, that's the wrong answer. Back to the one that you had earlier, yeah. So think about that space. Okay, now here is what was proposed in the United Nations Partition Plan in 1947, when the State of Israel was being formed. And what you have here is, let's see if we can, again, I don't know, can you tell that there's a kind of lined area in here, Kenny, but can you see that from where you are?
A little bit.
a little bit. There's a sort of smudgy area, that smudgy area, a little smudgy area over here, the Gaza Strip. The smudgy area is basically what the West Bank is now. Okay, so inside this area is what is present-day West Bank. The partition plan in 1947, this whole darker area was to be Palestinian area. So you can see that had the Palestinians at that time taken that option, they would have had more land.
Yeah,
it wasn't
the Palestinians. It was the Arab nations.
The Arab nations had agreed to that.
That UN proposal.
Yes, and they had the right to accept or reject it. This was supposed to be a kind of a mutual decision that was being suggested. So you have that idea. It wasn't accepted because as they looked at this, they said, "But wait a minute, you know, this is we're all over here. Why should we be only in here? You know, this is so." It's not an unreasonable thing to have said, with only 6% of the population Jewish, why will they have, you know, 54% of the land? So that's one of the reasons that this was not accepted at the time. As we look back in hindsight, of course, it would have been a better.
Where's Jerusalem on that?
Jerusalem is. Find it here first.
Down
about right here. Sorry, these maps aren't clear. Okay, next map. Okay, this is present day or the year 2000, and what you see are all these sort of little puddle areas. Within this is the West Bank. The white area is the West Bank, and the little gray areas, kind of puddles, are the areas that are theoretically under Palestinian control. So you see a lot of discontinuity between the places. It's not easy to get between the places that are Palestinian, and it's even harder than it looks on the map because it's guarded. And so to go from one to another, it continues to be an increasing problem. And this is.
Let me give you an example. Suppose you lived up in Nablus, which is up about here, and you wanted to go to Hebron, which is somewhere around here, and you were going for a wedding of a relative, you might spend, and it would take you, if you were driving in, quote, normal times, it would take you 2 hours, 2.5 hours. It might take you 23 hours to go, if you're allowed, through all the checkpoints to cover that distance, 23 hours. Or I mentioned yesterday that I attended a wedding in Amman of Viola Raheb, and I flew partially because of a matter of time. I didn't have time, even as an international, to spend 4 or 5 hours at the Allenby Bridge waiting to go across. A Palestinian will spend 3 days to get across at the Allenby Bridge. So what Viola Raheb did, and her family, and those who came from Bethlehem, when the curfew was lifted, which would be, say, from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. What they did was they essentially streaked to Jericho, which is the only unoccupied Palestinian city in the West Bank, where there is no place to stay. There are no hotels open, no place to stay. And then they got there, and then they spent the night there, sleeping in their cars. And then the next morning at 4:30, they got a ride by taxi to Allenby Bridge, which is just a couple of miles away from Jericho. And there they waited, even though they had official letters, they waited for many hours in order to cross.
So just keep this sort of picture, general picture, in your mind as we talk about further into the week some of the questions about whether or not the image of apartheid is appropriate in the Israeli-Palestinian context, and the idea of these being like little bantustans that are very separate, controlled by another government than those than the people who live inside them.
So can you distill this down? I may be totally wrong. The white is basically the Jewish state, and the puddle of Palestinians guarded by the Jewish, or is it the other way?
No, the white is the West Bank. This is supposed to be all the Palestinians. This is supposed to be what pre-1967 was Palestinian area. Right. But when we talk about going back to 1967 borders, which is one of the strong elements in the discussion, and that the United Nations has supported, et cetera, that Israel should go back to its 1967 borders, that means that this area would be under Palestinian control. It's the West Bank right here. And the area around it is Israel proper. That nobody is seriously contesting.
The tunnels are considered occupied.
This is occupied. This is the occupied West Bank.
In very plain English, go over what that means. Occupied by whom?
By Israelis. By the Israelis.
So in other words, Israel circles the West Bank.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It circles the West Bank, and then it circles. It within that, it's circling.
So the West Bank is kind of isolated then.
Yes.
Now I get it.
Yeah.
And it's getting more and more isolated. What happens is, if you want to bring a container of goods, say from manufactured in Italy to Ramallah, a center of economic activity on the West Bank, it'll land at, say, Haifa or Ashdod, and then it'll come by truck. After it's been thoroughly inspected and after customs have been collected by the Israelis, it'll come to a checkpoint entering into the West Bank. At that point, everything will be taken out of the container and put onto another truck and then move. And then maybe that will happen twice more in order for that container load of goods eventually to end up
in Ramallah. So economically, you can see this is an impossible situation. You can't have trade easy. Trade between these areas. You need permits to go from one area to another area. You need to have an ID to be able to enter Jerusalem, a special Jerusalem ID. Your ID permits are good for 1 month, and you have to be able to get to the place to get your... I'm talking about Palestinians when I say you. The Palestinians have to go to get these permits. They're good for 1 month, and then they have to be renewed. It's very difficult to travel anywhere.
You have to go to a special office, and to do that, it's very difficult, especially if you're under curfew.
So,
and even if you're not under curfew, you might not be allowed to cross a checkpoint to get to what's called a DCO, District Command Office, to do that. And the IDs are really critical. So can I just mention something? So for instance, let me come back to the wedding, because that's such a wonderful human gathering. At the wedding, the pastor at the church in Amman, Jordan, the pastor is Palestinian, as are most Jordanians, are originally Palestinian. He is a Jerusalemite. That is, his identity is from Jerusalem. Okay. He married a Jordanian Palestinian who grew up in a refugee camp in Amman. Okay. They are expected, he is pastor of the Church of the Good Shepherd in Amman. He went to seminary in Tanzania, which is a really wonderful way to go and think about seminary education. Up until very recently, all the ELCJ pastors went to Germany, or in the case of Bishop and Yunat, went to Finland. And so they are expecting a child in September. They have no idea what identity their child will have, whether the child will be able to have a passport or any type of identity card
either from the Jordanians
because or, from the, refugee
or from the Israelis. Mm-hmm. And there are many Palestinians that have American passports. I should, that's also a fascinating topic, as there are many Israelis that have American passports. Israel, it's very easy to have bi-nationality in Israel. And so you have Palestinians that have American passports and Palestinian identity. When they are in this area, they are treated only as Palestinians. They cannot be, they are not treated as Americans. That is, if I want to leave, I can go through an Israeli checkpoint unless it's a closed military zone. They will let me get to the airport. I will be able to fly out on the strength of my American passport. Palestinian can show the American passport and it's absolutely worthless. Mm-hmm. Worthless. They cannot leave. Only after they have cleared immigration does that American passport come into effect. When they are at the airport and they've been allowed to leave as Palestinian residents. And then
so
they can fly
is,
on the American
this
passport.
This is very interesting, especially considering that America is, you know, Israel's best friend. And to treat American citizens this way is an amazing, amazing thing.
When were all these restrictions put in place? Was that in 67?
Basically since 67, and most significantly since the Oslo Accords, since 93 and 95.
Yeah, and before
very,
the Oslo Accords,
fact.
It was a straight shot from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. There was no checkpoint. And then with the Oslo Accords, checkpoints began to appear.
And what was the reason given?
Security. It was very gradual. It was gradual. It was, I don't know. I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me, so it's hard for me to justify why it happened.
So wasn't there the first intifada? What were the years of the first intifada?
87 to 92.
Right.
Yeah.
And Oslo was 93. So,
yeah, right.
I mean, I think that my understanding is that a lot of those security measures came...
were part of the agreement out of the intifada, that's
right.
True. So that Israel was given to try to keep its, kind of feel like it was going to be safe. It was given a lot of control militarily over borders and security issues so that they didn't feel like they were going to be threatened while these trust-building efforts were being made over the course of the Oslo process. It does stem, at least in part, from that reality.
Maybe, I know we don't have
any... Why don't you turn on the lights again? And
yeah, why don't we just open up?
Yeah, we'll open for questions because we can't possibly think of anything else we're going to discover.
I'm just curious, how is the border divided between Jordan and the West Bank? Are there the same checkpoints there? Israelis control
Israelis
the border?
Control that border. Uh-huh. Israelis control all the borders.
Okay.
Right today, is there Israeli soldiers scattered out to go inside the West Bank?
Yes. 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 In fact, that map that I just showed you,
yeah.
You know, the whole area of the West Bank now is reoccupied militarily by Israel. Now, the idea is that this is going to be temporary, but the whole area is now occupied.
So where are all these settlements that we hear about? Are they all over the West Bank? Or?
There are little dots everywhere.
There's another dot on there?
It would look like someone had the measles if we were to show a map.
Right.
That began in
1967.
Sharon was one of the architects of the settlement policy. One of the things that's probably helpful to understand is that where the present state of Israel stood up until 1967, that was not biblical Israel. There were not many biblical sites. Tel Aviv was sand dunes. There was no biblical site, no religious significance to Tel Aviv, and the sites were in Judea and Samaria. And so there were religious Jews that wanted to be part of that. They wanted to be close to those sites. They wanted to occupy, to live in the areas that biblical Israel occupied 3,000 to 2,000 years ago. And so they have occupied. And there are also many secular Jews that live there simply because economically it is so much more advantageous to live on a settlement than to try to buy a house inside Israel, inside the Green Line. let me tell you a story that's true. Jerusalem municipal boundaries are constantly shifting. Partly it's an issue of demographics. The Israelis want to maintain a Jewish identity to that city. They want to make sure that there are always more Jews than Arabs or Palestinians. And so they shift the city to incorporate Jewish areas into the metropolitan boundaries of Jerusalem, and also to constrict Arab areas. So it's very difficult to get building permits, and I think maybe another day we can get into that. But there was a settlement that was built outside of Jerusalem with no connection to the municipal boundaries, so that modern Orthodox Jews could live. They wanted to live in the West Bank. They had ideological and religious reasons for that choice. They didn't particularly care about living in Jerusalem. They wanted to live in the West Bank as part of the movement to reclaim the land of biblical Israel. Okay? So they're there. They're not too far from Ramallah. So they're a little... Ramallah's north of Jerusalem, and they were sort of northeast of Jerusalem by a few miles. Okay, then there's the group of ultra-Orthodox, or the Haredim, like that man right there. They wanted to live in Jerusalem. Either within Jewish law, if you can see the city walls, you can consider yourself an inhabitant of the city. They wanted to be close to what was their spiritual core. Okay, so they wanted to live on a settlement too. They wanted to have the benefits of the housing subsidies and so on. And so what they did on this settlement, which was modern Orthodox in the West Bank, they created a second housing development on the same settlement that was for the Haredim. Then they expanded the boundaries of municipal Jerusalem to incorporate the ultra-Orthodox area of this settlement, so that they live inside the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem, and they are happy, and then the modern Orthodox live in the West Bank, and they're happy. Mm-hmm. On the same settlement. Now, how do we find this out? This is what is really important to know, that there are many Israeli Jews that realize that there is a fundamental injustice in the land, that they will never have security until Palestinians have justice. And so a guy named Jeff Halper, he's an anthropologist, he's an academic, he teaches at Ben-Gurion University in the southern part of Israel. And he's a Minnesotan, so when you talk to him, you feel like you're talking to a, you know how Minnesotan sounds. In understanding urban issues, I mentioned, let me just push this book briefly again, The Body and the Blood. This guy's an urban reporter, so he thinks if you understand urban New York, you can understand the West Bank. You understand how police forces work and how the unions work and so on. Jeff Halper is an academic, and he understands urban development. And so if you come, if you respond to our invitation to come, we can arrange a bus trip with Jeff Halper. And you just go to these sites and you see what the settlement looks like. You can always spot a settlement because it's nice and green and there's swimming pools. Maybe the nearby Palestinian village. It's brown and desolate and they don't appreciate nature. You know, they don't like trees and so on. You know, that's the way they live.
I'm Thank you so much for trying to settle there. But probably in terms of settlements, one of the important things to realize is that Jordan, when they were in control of the area up until 1967, had registered about one third of the land ownership during that time, which was a difficult task because there were deeds were kind of oral and local, and people didn't.
And so all the brothers of the family were on a plot of land.
So that was a very difficult thing. They'd gotten about one third of the way through the area that they were in charge of, and then in 1967, at the end of that war, Israel basically declared the rest of the area unowned.
That is, if you didn't have a clear deed that was acceptable in any kind of court, you didn't own the land.
So in their kind of legal structure, they can go ahead and just take this land because nobody owns it. And that's when they confiscate land. That's the basis for that, to be able to take it.
So they declare it state land, and then the next process is they'll put out tenders to say, does anybody want to build a housing development on this land? And then they'll respond to the inquiries, and lo and behold, there'll be a 500-unit housing project that's built. There's a permit price for the housing project, and it's not so much more than if you're a Palestinian and you want to build a three-story house because of the way that the real estate laws work in Israel.
There's a lot more to say about that. I'm sorry we didn't get more question answers. You're going to have one session probably of questions and answers. But that's the idea basically here is that sharing of the land obviously is a huge issue. Protecting of holy sites, which we didn't really get into in any great detail, is also extraordinarily significant, and the kind of movement between the political kind of movement between what is just land and what is a religious issue gets very interesting and complex as well. So thank you.